Well, what I wanted to talk about today was this a little bit of an update on some things related to global warming, which is, you know, one of the reasons I think hybrid technology and alternative fuel vehicles and so on are going to be just something we have to be thinking about in this country in the future. But also want to try to wrap it around this kind of larger objective that we have to be thinking about, I would argue, about sustainability. It's sort of, you know, how do we want to live long term in the future without compromising our lives or lives that come after us? So I'm going to just share a few thoughts about that today and see where that goes. We're going until about like 150 or something like that, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. Well, if you had to sum up all the things that we're concerned about today in terms of the environment, in terms of economics, in terms of social welfare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, this may be the simplest slide you could ever put up. Sorry that it's a curse. It might be not a polite thing to do to you. But this argument that we live in interesting times. I think if you asked a historian or anybody who's, you know, well-read or anything like that, they probably would say that, yeah, right now is perhaps the most interesting and exciting and powerful time in human history, but it also may be one of the most dangerous and challenging times in human history. And that's saying a lot because, you know, human history is a very, very long period of time. So when we think about that, what are some of the good things about our era? Well, one of the things as a scientist I particularly like is our ability to really see and understand our changing planet, our ability to kind of visualize the planet as a single place. The idea that, you know, in a single human retina can encompass the entire scope of the Earth at once. That's really extraordinary. And, you know, people after 1957 or so, or, you know, after Sputnik, were the first people in the world to ever in human history to appreciate that fact. And I think that's a real privilege. But it's also a time of incredible change. And this is one of the things, this is probably the biggest danger we face, isn't that things are changing, but that things are changing so fast compared to any previous human experience. That's something that is really challenging our ability to cope with new challenges, is that they're happening so much more quickly than they ever have before. Let me put that in perspective a little bit. If you just look at the last 50 years of the 20th century, or, you know, the last 50 years or so, what we find here is that over the world, human population actually more than doubled. Nowadays, it's really 7 billion. The official UN number is 6.56 or something like that, but it's really around 7. There's a lot, believe it or not, there are half a billion people not counted in the world, hidden all over the place. But anyway, human population about doubled in just 50 years during, you know, much less than a human lifetime compared to all previous human history. 5 million years of hominid evolution. And then in 50 years, we double human population. That's extraordinary. On top of that, people talk like, oh, population's a big issue. Well, yeah, it is. But the economy, that is the goods and services traded and used across the planet, increased way more than that. It increased sevenfold and has no signs of slowing down at all, whereas population growth is stabilizing, thank goodness. One of the other things that's happened, of course, with many more people, many more goods and services used around the world, is our need for food has gone up. Agriculture has roughly tripled in only 50 years compared to 10,000 years of agriculture before it. In 50 years, we triple it. What we find is food consumption has tripled. Water consumption along with that has tripled. Just extraordinary. And then, of course, what a lot of you are interested in, I think, is energy use. Not just gasoline, of course, but coal, oil, everything else. Fossil fuels, that is the, you know, the big pillar of our civilization right now, the use of fossil fuels just until 2000 increased fourfold. Today, it has increased by fivefold roughly. So that's extraordinary. Okay? These are big, big changes, and we don't know what they mean. But we do know that the planet has started to notice. Okay? This has been really extraordinary. And one of the ways it's noticed, of course, is in the composition of the air itself. This little curve here is a pretty famous little curve in my field called the Keeling curve, named after a guy who measured it starting in the late 50s. But the bottom line here is this is showing the levels of carbon dioxide, a gas that we call a greenhouse gas. It traps infrared radiation, traps heat in the atmosphere. A lot of other gases too, water vapor, et cetera. But this one has been going up steadily since we started measuring it in the 1950s. In fact, when we go back in time and look for ancient air samples and funny things like ice cores, we see that it's been rising ever since, well, really the 1850s and earlier, ever since the Industrial Revolution. Well, this isn't the only thing going up. Methane's going up, nitrous oxide's going up, other gases are going up, and all of these have the ability to trap heat in our atmosphere, especially at night and in the winter, and warm the planet, keep it from cooling off to outer space the way it normally does. So this is the idea of global warming, right? Well, you've all heard this before, right? Unless you've been in some undisclosed location for the last 6.5 years, let's say. I don't know what I'm talking about. Never mind. You've probably heard about this before, right? This is a big issue. It's been in the news a lot. Let me just get to the bottom line here. This is really, really basic physics, okay? There's nothing to it. There's science behind this. It's incredibly simple, actually. The details are complicated, but the basic idea is really, really simple. And here it is. Here's the gist of it. Our atmosphere, and not just ours, every planet we've ever looked at has the same thing going on. So it's not just Earth. We know how this works. Anyway, Earth basically is this little guy to the right. Sunshine comes in from the sun, like it is today, comes in and warms the Earth's surface. Nice sunny day, right? Warms the Earth's surface. The Earth warms up, and things that warm up give off radiation themselves, electromagnetic radiation, in the form of infrared radiation, or kind of heat radiation. You and I do that too. The floor is doing it. These lights are doing it. Everything around us is giving off radiation, whether we can see it or not. Well, the Earth is giving off infrared radiation into outer space. And if it weren't for an atmosphere, it would just shoot right on out there, no problem. It would be right in balance with the sunshine hitting it. The problem is with this atmosphere here, some of that infrared radiation gets absorbed by the molecules in the air, especially water vapor, a natural greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, and methane, etc. Now, some of those gases are getting more abundant in the atmosphere. It's like making your blanket a little thicker in the winter or putting on extra sheets on your bed. So you're going to be a little toastier underneath those thicker blankets, right? So the blanket of our atmosphere is getting a little bit thicker, and it's making the planet a little warmer. Now, the first thing I should point out, though, to be very, very honest about this, is a lot of the climate skeptics, the people who are kind of what I call science hitmen, they're kind of professionals who are deliberately hired to go out there and make this science look confusing to people. It's a very deliberate strategy, okay? It has nothing to do with actual science. It has something to do with corporate interests, mainly. But what's going on here is that this infrared radiation is going out to outer space, but it's being absorbed. Some of it's re-emitted to the surface, warming the planet. The greenhouse effect, though, is a natural process. Okay, the climate skeptic guys will try to point that out and confuse people. Yes, Earth has always had a natural greenhouse effect. In fact, our planet is about 15 degrees warmer than it would be otherwise. If it weren't for the presence of these greenhouse gases or so. What we're doing, though, is we're making that even a little bit warmer, shifting our climate that we've had pretty much the same climate for 10,000 years. We're shifting it very rapidly into a warmer climate and one that we have not experienced for hundreds of millions of years, anything quite like this climate. And whenever you see a big shift in climate, we know in the geologic record there have been extinctions, massive disruptions, etc., and that could be pretty bad for us. Okay? It's not that this isn't like a natural phenomena. Yeah, we've always had a toastier planet that you might not have, but now we're going to make it a little toastier, and we're not used to that. What is that going to mean? That's the issue. Now, I'm not saying we're going to do this, but it's just this is a cautionary tale just to our next-door neighbor, Venus. Is that has a massive greenhouse effect, and it's due to the presence of CO2. Anybody who tells you CO2 doesn't cause greenhouse warming is full of it, because we know we can look at Mars, we can look at Venus, we can look at the moons of Jupiter, and we can see it actually working on those planets just as well. Here's Venus. It has a 280 degree Celsius greenhouse effect. That is, it's that much warmer because of CO2. We can calculate it and go measure it, and yep, that's what it is. That's about 500 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it would have been otherwise. That's extraordinary. You don't want to do that. That's bad, okay? Don't do that, X. Okay, so this is basically greenhouse physics, very simple. This is also not a new idea, okay? Some people might believe that Al Gore discovered the greenhouse effect in 2005, just after he invented the internet or something, right? Not quite true. He gets a lot of credit for popularizing the science of this and does, frankly, a very good job of it, of communicating that stuff. Not 100%, but it's pretty damn good. What we see here, though, is, in fact, the greenhouse effect was first discovered back in the 1850s by Joseph Fourier, a French mathematician some of you might remember, but then very, very carefully calculated out and thought over by these two guys, Arrhenius, who was a chemist in Sweden back in the 1880s. You might remember that name from your high school chemistry course, the Arrhenius rate. I couldn't even remember that until somebody told me about that. But supposedly you were told this in high school chemistry. I don't remember it. But anyway, and this guy here from Madison, believe it or not, T.C. Chamberlain. Some of you know Chamberlain Street, Chamberlain Hall on campus, if you're from the Madison area. He later became the president of the University of Chicago. He wrote papers about the greenhouse effect that still hold up today back in the 1890s. Okay? So this is like an 1800s physics. This is stuff, you know, that's really pretty basic. It's just conservation of energy. So if you tell me you don't believe in the greenhouse effect, then I'm just going to say, well, do you believe the Earth is round? Or, you know, do you really like using the light bulb in your house? Because that's kind of how this works, conservation of energy. Do you like your cell phone? Do you like your laptop? I mean, if you don't believe in this kind of physics, then I don't know how you get by every day, okay? So this is pretty basic stuff. So there's the theory. It's pretty old stuff. We know basically how it works very, very well. Where's the evidence, though? Okay, well, let me show you. This is another thing the greenhouse skeptics won't do, by the way. They'll never show you any data. They'll just criticize other people's data. They will never actually show you evidence for their own ideas. Very interesting. That's something that tells you what's a real scientist and who's a charlatan. Where's your data? Oh, well, I didn't bring any. Well, anyway, here's the climate record of the last 2,000 years. This has been criticized a little bit, but there are thousands of reconstructions of this now, and they all show basically the same phenomena. Bottom line here is this is a temperature reconstruction for the Earth. And we don't have thermometers that are 1,000 years old that we can look at and tell us what the temperature was. But we do have things like tree rings and ice cores and pollen and the lake sediments. We can kind of dig those up and infer the temperature of what things were like a long time ago. And what we find is that actually the last 1,000 years have had a pretty normal climate. Here's the little ice age period, et cetera, but which had nothing to do with global warming. It's a totally different phenomenon. But starting along the period where industrial activities really got going, we see this very large warming, a little bit of a blip here that we don't totally understand, to be honest. But overall, there's a very, very large warming that is way, way out of range of anything we've seen for at least 1,000 years, and very likely anything we've seen for, well, actually about 500,000 or 600,000 years. So this is really, really unusual. Let's zoom into the last 100 years. This is the warming we've seen in the last century, globally now. Now, this is actually pretty significant. This turns out to be a very, very robust trend. And what we see is the planet has warmed about 1 degree centigrade, which is about 2 degree Fahrenheit change, in just the last 100 years. Now, you might say, 2 degrees, big deal. You know, what do I care about that? I changed my thermostat 2 degrees, and I don't even notice it. Well, think of it this way. The planet is a really big thing. If you change the temperature of the whole planet on average, that's a big change in our climate. During the last ice age, for example, when this place here was covered in about a mile of ice, the temperature of Earth was about 3 degrees centigrade colder than now. We've already warmed it 1 degree in the other direction. So a change of 2 to 3 degrees means you rewrite the maps of the Earth. It's a fundamental change in the climates of many places when the overall temperature is. Just like you and me, like when we have a temperature change of our bodies of about a degree or two, you start to have a fever. 3 or 4 degrees, you start to get really sick, okay? That's the kind of indicator we're talking about. So that's what we've seen over the last 100 years. What about, like, are we breaking records? We seem to be. You hear this all the time. I haven't heard of any cold records being broken for a long time. But what about hot records? Well, if you look at the 10 warmest years ever recorded, they all occurred in the last 14 years. The warmest year ever is 2005. The second warmest year, I got to update this thing already, is 2006. So this is really pretty wild. We're also seeing it not just in temperature records. You've all probably heard about glaciers melting all over the world. This is just a little cartoon, not an accurate map, but kind of showing regions where we see glaciers melting. Now, again, let me give you some BS detector here. Again, the climate skeptic types, and especially this guy on Fox News once in a while, will tell you that there's areas of Greenland and Antarctica where glaciers are getting bigger. And I'll tell you right now that that's absolutely true. And you know what? That's actually a sign of global warming, believe it or not. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you're in the middle of Greenland or the middle of Antarctica, it's really, really cold. It's colder than Wisconsin, okay? And it's really cold. So if it's 40 below and global warming is now making it 35 below or 30 below, it's still below zero. It's still really friggin' cold, and it's not going to melt any snow or ice for a while, is it? But you know this expression in Wisconsin, like it's too cold to snow in the winter? Well, that's true. When the air gets really cold, it can't hold any moisture. So when you warm up the air a little bit, but keep it below freezing, you can make the air hold a little bit more moisture, and it's going to actually snow more. So ironically, in the coldest parts of the Earth, a little bit of warming, which has already been seen, is increasing the amount of snow they get, because they're not getting above freezing yet, but it's a little warmer. And that point is getting more snow on the ice, making the snow last a little longer, making the glaciers be a little bigger. So, in fact, that's entirely consistent. So don't get confused by it. That's another very deliberate point of confusing people on purpose, just to kind of deliberately build a smokescreen. That just makes me sick, because anybody who thinks about the science there would know what's going on. But anyway, all the red places where a little bit of warming, kind of on the edge of where glaciers are, these are where glaciers are melting like crazy, everywhere in the red. Let me show you a couple examples of what that might look like here in the United States. This is, there's, you know, Glacier National Park, or soon to be called the park formerly known as Glacier, because it's going away. But up in Alaska, here's one of my favorite glaciers. This is the Muir Glacier in 1941, photographed here, a big, beautiful glacier here. Here it is again in 2004, the same place, same time of year. Glacier's gone, guys. There's a new lake here, and believe it or not, a new forest, which shouldn't be there. Here we have the Toboggan Glacier, also in Alaska, 1909. Beautiful glacial moraine building up here. Again, this is what it looks like in 2004. It's gone, replaced by a forest. And, you know, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of these things. And I'm not going to show them all to you today. Could if you want, but not today. Sea ice, another indicator, another kind of canary in the coal mine. Up in the Arctic Ocean, you know, the top of the world, you know, Santa's got his work cut out for him, because where he lives is actually ocean. There's no land up there. It's an ocean with ice on the top of it because it's so cold, called sea ice. Well, sea ice has actually been steadily going down. Santa's got to think about relocating pretty soon, because the amount of sea ice is actually steadily going down over the decades. We've been measuring this from satellites. Here are some pictures of the most recent few years of sea ice cover in the summertime when it starts to shrink a little bit. You might not be able to make it out, but there's a little kind of yellow line around here. That's where the sea ice used to be in the winter, in the summertime. That's where it should be. This is where it's been the last few years. This is 2005, which is the smallest amount of sea ice ever recorded through the satellite measurements or from ships. And those records go back about 300 to 400 years in from Norwegian whaling ships, et cetera, or in Iceland. So again, we're seeing a very, very dramatic loss of sea ice cover in the Arctic as well. This is huge. One last example, and again, you know, I could keep talking about this all day, and sometimes I do, ask my students. But the problem here is we're also seeing this even where we live. And one of the things you're seeing in Wisconsin, climate changes in Wisconsin have actually been fairly subtle. But one of the things we've seen here is, one, the lake ice records are showing that all the lakes are showing shorter duration. If you go ice fishing, you know that already. But it's also showing up in our plants. Actually, the Leopold family actually documented this quite nicely. But even across the whole northern hemisphere, if you look at the time that plants turn green in the spring to the time that they turn brown in the fall, it's getting longer. And we can actually see that in the last couple decades from satellites. Everywhere in this green are places where it's getting a longer and longer growing season. Now, at first, you might say, well, gee, that's great. We got more plants. We can grow bigger crops and that kind of thing. I'm like, well, yeah, but the climate of Wisconsin is going to turn into the climate of like Arkansas or North Carolina. We're not sure yet how much wetter it's going to be. I didn't move to North Carolina. I moved to Wisconsin. I don't want to live in North Carolina, okay? And we certainly don't want to be messing with our climate that rapidly. Now, sure, it might mean we can grow different crops, but it also means different insects will move here, different kinds of pests, weeds, etc. Ironically, and I'm just a slight tangent, one of the plants that's going to do incredibly well at a global warming planet, a warmer, wetter, and more CO2-abundant atmosphere, the plants that seem to love it are ragweed and poison ivy. Really love it. Opportunistic weed. There are certain plants that are intentionally, have evolved to kind of take advantage of ecological disruption, and those are the weeds. They're going to love this world in the next 50 years. So if you've got allergies, just stay tuned. Okay, seriously, people are really worried about that, actually. So there's a lot of evidence. Literally could go on for days and days and days. Now, another point that I just have to make this, and I'm sorry, that I keep hammering this point, but when you hear this kind of so-called scientific debate about climate change, I'll get to that point a little bit more, there really isn't one. But what the point is that scientists who work on this issue should be asked, show me your evidence. You should demand that of scientists or on any issue. And so I'm trying to show you the evidence we have on the global warming side, saying that, yeah, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of data. It's all in the public domain. Every paper is free and downloadable. You can get it yourself. You can look at it yourself. It's great. The climate skeptic guys, when you ask them, where's your data? They don't seem to have very much or any. Where have you published this? Has it been peer reviewed? Well, no. I'll get to that point again in a minute, but it's important to say, show me the data, okay? So anyways, despite all of this evidence, huge amounts of evidence that's in the public domain, completely transparent, completely free, all available to everybody in the world, despite that, there's still a lot of myths about climate change. It just kind of blows my mind. Well, let me go through a few myths. I want to do some myth shattering today, just to maybe equip you when you go home. You know, we all have that kind of crazy brother-in-law we see at Thanksgiving who'll tell us this is all hooey. I'm going to help you equip yourself for that. You're a crazy brother-in-law. I got one of those too. So anyway, this is my favorite one. The first time I heard this is, well, you know, global warming is just a theory. And I kind of laughed and said, well, you're absolutely right. And they kind of looked at me like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, you're absolutely right. Global warming is a theory. Now, the problem I think here is that you might not know what theory means to scientists. A theory is not the same thing as like a wild ass guess, okay? Scientists do have a word for that. We call it a hypothesis, okay? Scientists will never say wild ass guess in their papers, okay? They should, but they don't. They'll say, our hypothesis is, so we take what we call a hypothesis. It's sort of an idea, a guess. And then we test it in the laboratory against computer models, against real world observations, against previously established theories. And test it and test it and test it. And if there's a single point of evidence saying that this ain't true, we toss it out and put it on the rubbish heap. 95% of scientific ideas get thrown out that way. The hypothesis failed. When they stand up, though, they become, after many decades of testing and testing and testing, and nothing shows that this ain't true, it becomes what scientists, anyway, call a theory. So yeah, global warming is a theory. Evolution is a theory. So isn't gravity. So isn't the Earth is round. So isn't that the Earth goes around the sun. All of these theories show every single piece of evidence supports them, and they work pretty darn well. So yeah, global warming happens to be a theory, and that's a good thing, actually. What they probably really mean is, well, you scientists aren't sure. That's what they kind of mean when people throw out the word theory. And maybe I'm just being funny, but the theory thing is important. But this idea really means you scientists aren't sure. And well, that's absolutely not true, okay? There's been a very, very deliberate attempt to make Americans believe the scientists aren't sure. You probably heard about this, but there was a memo leaked correspondence between ExxonMobil and the Republican National Committee a number of years ago that was actually leaked to the press a number of years ago. Pointing out that there's a think tank that basically was saying, as long as we position global warming as theory instead of fact, as long as we attack the science, people won't demand policy change. If people are uncertain and they don't really want to change their ways because people are reluctant to change, then we've got it made. Delay, delay, delay. The similarity to what the tobacco companies did early on about links between smoking and cancer is actually kind of eerie. It's almost identical, and some of the same people were involved, actually, believe it or not. But this question about scientists aren't sure, I'm not going to just stand here and tell you that. I'm going to prove it. Again, I'll show you data. You don't believe me? You can look at it yourself. So if you look at scientific publication, now scientists communicate with each other through these big, weird things, you know, scientific journals, dusty things in the library, nowadays on the internet, that nobody in their right mind would read unless you worked in the field, okay? But that's how we talk to each other, because they're full of data, they're full of evidence, and when I publish a paper, my colleagues all around the world will try to tear it apart and say, where's the data? Where's the evidence? I don't believe you at all until you show me every scintilla of evidence. It's kind of like a courtroom. Imagine I'm an expert in a murder trial and I came to court with no evidence, I'd be laughed out of the room. Same thing in science. When I go to my professional setting, you gotta show them the data, you gotta put it through a rigorous kind of peer review where people try to tear you apart, and if it survives, it gets in a journal. Well, if you go to those journals and look for what are the articles that survived and really had data and really had evidence to show what's going on, well, somebody actually went and did that. They got out all the papers of the last 5 years, they took a random sample of all those, and they found about 1,000 papers they looked at really carefully. And they said, well, does this paper say that global warming is real and that people might be causing it? Well, of all the papers they looked at 928 of them. I don't know why they didn't go to 1,000, but anyway, they went to 928. And then they found, of the 928, 928 of them said that global warming is real and people were causing it. Zero showed otherwise, not one. So, and another point I'd like to make too, this is not some grand conspiracy. If anybody could prove that global warming wasn't real, they would win the Nobel Prize, okay? People love that kind of stuff. We all really want that to be true. But anyway, there's no evidence, zilch. Every scientific organization in the world has agreed to this. However, a handful of professional kind of skeptics are out there, and probably some people who are just sitting on the fence, but there are a handful of kind of agent provocateurs who are being hired to go out there to deliberately cause misinformation to make it appear to everybody else in America that this is still a debate, when in the real scientific world, there's no debate at all. So that's really, I mean, it's cynical as hell and scary, but that's what's going on. This is one of my favorite ones. This is my favorite myth. I first learned of this from one of my neighbors. We used to live in the east side of town and lived in a great neighborhood with one of our neighbors was this great guy. I'll call him Brian, that's his name. He came out of his house one morning when I was going to work, and he said, hey, John, come here. I got to ask you something. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, I figured he was going to ask me something about, you know, I don't know, about our lawn or something. I don't know. But anyway, he came over, and he's just a regular guy, just total, solid, regular, hardworking Wisconsin guy. Just the kind of guy you want to have as a neighbor. Great guy. Anyway, he came up to me and says, hey, John, yeah, you know. And he literally looked up and down the street to kind of make sure we're alone. And I was like, okay. And he said, hey, you work in this environmental stuff, right? You're a professor down on the campus, don't you? I'm like, yeah, you know. And I'm like, well, do you work on this global warming stuff? And I said, yeah, actually I do. That's part of what I do, is work on climate change a little bit. He says, well, okay. And he literally leaned in, made sure we were alone, and he kind of whispered. He said, you can let me in on the secret, okay? I won't tell anybody. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, and he said, no, come on, you know, don't try to fool me. I won't tell anybody, honest. I just want to know, you know, what's the big plan? You know, let me in on the secret. And I looked at him like, what are you talking about? And he said, okay, I'll pretend, you know, you go ahead and pretend you don't know, wink, wink, that, you know, there's a big, huge liberal conspiracy out there between the scientists and the Sierra Club and the UN to destroy the fossil fuel industry and hurt America. And, you know, he went on and on and on, you know. And, you know, about something about a new world order and the UN taking over and about, you know, wrecking the American economy and all this kind of stuff. And my eyes are about bugging out of my head at this point. I'm like, where did you hear this? And he said, well, you know, I heard it on talk radio. Rush talks about it. And a couple. And now, to his credit, Rush Limbaugh's changed his tune on global warming a little bit. But there are other people, believe it or not, like Michael Crichton, you know, a guy who came up with Jurassic Park. He's a medical doctor. He wrote a book called State of Fear, where he says scientists and environmental groups are engaged in a massive international conspiracy to wreck the world's economy or something by pretending global warming is real. So if this guy, it's very entertaining. Rush Limbaugh is very entertaining. This is not news, though. This is not information. It's entertainment, okay? But the scary one is there's actually the Senator James Imhoff from Oklahoma, who up until the last election was the chair of the Senate's Natural Resources and Environment Committee, also believes this and is very, very public. Well, at least he's, you know, his. I don't know if he really believes it, but that's what he's being paid to believe. This is really fundamentally wild. So anyway, I looked at Brian, and you know, my eyes were just about to bug out of my head. I'm like, my God, are you serious? You actually believe this stuff? Now I got to listen to these guys more often, I guess. And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, Brian, first of all, don't assume anybody's politics. If you think I'm some kind of liberal tree hugger, you're absolutely wrong. But despite that, the more important part is that I'm trying to figure how do I convince them? You know, I kept on telling him like. You know, there's no conspiracy. He says, yeah, sure, that's what all conspiracies say. And I'm like, oh, God, how do you win? You know, you can't win against a conspiracy theorist. Until I finally thought of the right answer. I said, do you honestly believe that a bunch of university professors and Birkenstock-wearing liberal environmentalists could pull off a major international conspiracy? They could outwit the oil companies. They could outwit everybody in the world except Rush Limbaugh and George W. Bush. And he kind of looked at me and said, oh my God, I never thought of it that way. Like, you couldn't pull it off even if you tried. You know, oh my God. And he just totally turned around. He went out and he bought a hybrid car about a year later, and he converted all his light bulbs to compact fluorescents. I think he still listens to Rush, but you know, whatever. You know. So again, if there, you think left-wing conspiracy, that's a contradiction in terms. There isn't one. Anyway, so again, those are some myths that you can debunk at your next Thanksgiving dinner with your family. But anyway, you know, we can make light of this and kind of laugh about this and talk about the silly debates we have in America and all the problems of the media and all this kind of stuff. But I also want to point out that this is a really serious human dilemma, too. We got to take this very seriously, and it's really pretty scary what this could mean. You know, I have a pretty high tolerance for being scared about the environment, okay? I work in the gloom and doom world every day. I mean, people like me don't get invited to parties very much, all right? Or if we do, never more than once. And this is some of the reasons. So, you know, if I keep up at night about this kind of stuff, this may be something, you know, you want to think about. One of the things that keeps me up about global warming at night isn't so much what's going to happen to the polar bears and this kind of stuff. I care about that. But what really worries me is pictures like this. This is a computer-generated map, basically, of what we think could happen to agriculture by the end of the century if climate changes happen the way we expect. Well, the bottom line of this is, and don't worry about the details too much, is everywhere that's in the red areas are places that could grow more food in the future. If you want to cut down the forests of Canada and Siberia, by the end of the century you could do that and probably grow wheat and corn up there. Everywhere in the blue, though, are places where it's going to get harder and harder to grow food because it's getting too hot and mainly too dry. That includes a lot of the Great Plains. Well, we already irrigate a lot of that, but watch out for the Great Lakes at that point. Also, though, look very carefully at Africa and Southern Asia and a lot of the, you know, a lot of the tropics, but especially Africa. It's going to get really hard to grow food there. And this is part of the world where food security and poverty are already huge problems, where AIDS and malaria are killing people, where the life expectancies, especially in Southern Africa, are dropping. They're now about 35 years at this point. Devastating poverty, devastating health problems. And now we're throwing the problem of climate change at them. And ironically, these are the people who didn't cause any of this pollution. This is not a good idea, not just morally, but in terms of our security. Let's also think about human health. This is a picture showing the country-by-country emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, principally CO2, in the year 2000. The United States in that year was number one, China number two, and if you added up all the European countries, they would be number three in one big block. This is already out of date. The U.S. finally is number two on that list. I don't mind being number two on that list, but China has become number one on that list as of about June of this year. So we're now the second largest greenhouse gas emitter, second to China. Anyway, these are the big polluters, U.S., Europe, and China. Everywhere else is not a big polluter. Well, the other question we asked was, and this is from real-world data, we asked the question, if climate change is already starting to happen and we're already seeing temperature changes, is this affecting people? Is it affecting their health? And one of the ways we see temperature changes affect health is especially in poor countries. You can look at the data of death rates and sickness rates in different parts of the world. And in poor countries, what you find is when temperatures go up, so do death rates. Because water goes bad when it's hot out. Food goes bad when it's hot out. You get more mosquitoes when it's hot out. You get more malaria when it's hot out. People are more stressed when it's hot out, especially if they're immunocompromised, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we looked at basically how have death rates gone up correlated with temperature and how has that changed over the last 50 years? And we looked at this and we found the following. This is a map of where deaths are higher now than they should be solely explained by temperature. That is, everywhere that's yellow and red basically are places where more people are dying today because it's hotter today. These are avoidable deaths due to climate change. How many people is this? Well, it turns out to be about 150,000 people a year, conservatively. I think it's probably at least double to triple that number, but at least 150,000 a year. Well, that number kind of strikes home for me because that's about the size, a little bit less, about the size of Madison, Wisconsin. It'd be like if somebody dropped a nuclear bomb on the isthmus and nobody noticed in the rest of the world. 150,000 people instantaneously die, and oh, we do it every year. So we drop a bomb somewhere once a year, and nobody noticed. That's the impact. 50 times the toll of the World Trade Center, but there's no war on global warming. And it's happening every year. This is extraordinary, and it demands some kind of reaction. The thing about climate change, and this is the summary for me, like why I stay up at night thinking about this stuff, is the places that are most sensitive to climate change, places like the Arctic, coral reefs, tropical countries, poor countries, small islands, I didn't even talk about that. The irony is the places that are most damaged have people that emitted very little pollution. They're very vulnerable, but they're also the world's poorest people for the most part. This is, I think, a security issue. The Pentagon takes this very seriously, even if the White House does not, because we don't want to be destabilizing the world's poorest countries and then having the U.S. and Europe be blamed for it. We do not want millions and millions of refugees. You think Darfur is bad, just wait. And we don't really need this kind of moral issue hanging over us as a country, and then individually, is that something we want? Now, I'm not going to tell you what to think morally, of course. Nobody should do that. But maybe we should ask the question of ourselves, is this the kind of world we want to leave behind for future generations? I don't know. So this is pretty bad stuff. Remember I told you, I'm the master of doom and gloom, right? Okay. You want to invite me to a party now? Yeah, I don't think so. So this is pretty bad. This is really bad stuff. Unfortunately, I'm not done yet. It's actually a lot worse than I just told you. One of the things that's really bad about this is that global warming isn't happening by itself. This is a real danger we get into sometimes in science, is we tend to focus on one problem like we do in a test tube and pretend we have controlled the world and that's the only thing happening in the world. The real world doesn't work like that. We don't have just global warming happening on Earth. Global warming is happening at the same time we're doing tropical deforestation, at the same time we're polluting the oceans and overfishing them, at the same time we have new viruses emerging all over the place, at the same time we're over-salinizing the soils, at the same time we're polluting our lakes in Wisconsin. And we don't know what that means. All we know is global warming is kind of one symptom, if you will, of a planet being pushed to the limits. And there are many, many more. One of the other ones I would argue is the widespread use of industrial agriculture. When we look all over the world, we see huge amounts of land being converted to agriculture or have been already. These are pictures of farms from outer space. Here's what Minnesota looks like from a satellite. Kansas, see those little circles of irrigation. A farmland landscape in a village in Germany. This is a rainforest in Bolivia being cleared. These are rice paddies in Thailand. This is a rainforest cleared for soybeans in Brazil. Really extraordinary. And when we look all over the world, we've actually used about 40%. I won't go through all the statistics here, but we've used about 40% of all the land there is for agriculture. We think when you hear land use as an environmental problem, you typically think of a Walmart. I think of a plow. Okay? We have about 10 times more land in agriculture than we do in suburbs and cities, folks. Okay? Suburban sprawl is not a big environmental problem compared to agriculture. Okay? So I think, anyway, you could argue that, but it's much, 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 much more in agriculture than it is in cities. Water use, again, a huge issue, mainly tied to agriculture in dry regions, is happening all over the world. Here's the Aral Sea shrinking because of over-irrigation. Here's Lake Chad. Only 95% of Lake Chad is gone now, mainly due to shifts in climate and over-irrigation in the dry part of Africa. Again, we're using a huge amount of water and land, and we're not done. We're also using a lot of fertilizers and a lot of chemicals in our agriculture, as you know. Just look at Madison Lakes. 80% of the wells in Dane County, Wisconsin, are polluted from nitrate, chemical fertilizer used in cornfields mainly. And fertilizer use is so bad in the upper Midwest now that all this red area is basically where we dump Miracle-Gro, mainly on corn, not so much soybeans. And that stuff flushes right down into the Mississippi River and dumps out of the Gulf of Mexico. And I'm not just going to tell you that. I'm going to show you that. That is a phytoplankton bloom off the coast of the Mississippi Delta, largely because of all the chemicals we dump into the Gulf of Mexico. The result of that, if you dumped so much Miracle-Gro into the oceans, is there's going to be a lot of plant life there, but those plants in the upper layer of the ocean settle down and decompose in the lower layers of the ocean, causing what's called a dead zone or hypoxic zone, where the oxygen in the water is gone. This area, called by fishermen the dead zone, is where there are no shrimp and no fish anymore because of all this pollution. Okay, when we just planted 12 million additional acres in corn this year alone to grow more ethanol crops for corn, this could be the worst year ever for the Gulf of Mexico. So, you know, ethanol, unfortunately, from corn is no friend of fishermen in the south in the Gulf of Mexico right now. That's a big, big problem. And nobody's talking about it, unfortunately. The point here is, though, again, I don't have time to go through all these kinds of details. Just remember the danger of a world where all of this stuff is hitting the fan at the same time, and we don't really know what it's going to mean. What we do know what it means is that environmental problems now are going to be so much bigger than we ever had before that entire parts of our planet are really literally on the brink. Not just a little park or one species, but entire regions of our biosphere are literally, literally on edge. I'm going to just whip through this quickly, but one of the places we need to worry about is the Arctic, because global warming is really strong up there. We're already seeing it, seeing the loss of sea ice. Here's a map of Alaska showing what's happening to forest in Alaska. All of the brown areas are where forests have been burning down, and the green areas are where forests are growing where they shouldn't be. That used to be tundra, areas of, you know, kind of snow and grasses covered by the snow, and now it's being invaded by forest. Taking a surface that used to be snow-covered over grasses like the tundra used to be and turning them into dark green trees makes them more sunshine and makes them even warmer, which means a very, very strong kind of feedback. And we worry that the Arctic literally is at this so-called tipping point where you could have a fundamentally different Arctic than we've seen in millions and millions of years. And it's already happening. Coral reefs is another one we need to be watching really carefully because the warmer ocean temperatures are killing corals all over the world through coral bleaching. Those pictures of healthy and dead corals on the left and the right. One of the other things, though, about this is kind of scary is we already over-harvest and fish these regions. There are new diseases moving in there. But also the oceans are getting, believe it or not, more and more acidic. This is something we kind of didn't anticipate, didn't think about too much, believe it or not. But as carbon dioxide builds up in the atmosphere, causing a greenhouse effect, a little bit of it actually dissolves in the water, too. The water has to be in chemical equilibrium with the air. So a little bit of that CO2 dissolves in water. And you know what happens when you put CO2 in water? You get carbonated water, basically, carbonic acid. So the oceans are getting slightly more acidic. They're still not too acidic, but a little bit. And as they move more and more down the acid chain, if you will, then what happens is you can't make coral reefs anymore. At a pH of about 7.5, you can't grow coral reefs on this planet. The oceans are now at 7.9. So within 20 to 30 years, almost inevitably, the world's coral reefs will disappear completely. Not just a few, all of them, period. And that's just in the chemistry. So we warm the oceans, we make them more acidic, and then we're beating the hell out of them at the same time. It's very, very likely there will not be coral reefs on this planet by mid-century. So within our lifetime. So if you want to see them now. Tropical rainforest is another. This is kind of a farewell tour of Earth, you know. Earth, the farewell tour. Go see the Arctic. Go see the coral reefs. I should start a travel business, you know. See the stuff before they're gone. Another place, tropical rainforest, might be kind of good. We already know they're being deforested like crazy. Again, the kind of biofuels push might be causing an acceleration of this. Certainly soybean for beef cattle has done this quite a lot. But one of the things we didn't really anticipate, scientists didn't think about this, is that when you cut open a nice moist green rainforest and make them look like this with a bunch of dead trees on the ground that can bake in the sun during the dry season, you make a basically a whole bunch of kindling, which can start fires and then they can spread into areas that weren't intended to be burned. So somebody might cut down 1 acre of rainforest, then 2 more acres burn down. So in fact, the degradation of rainforest has been a lot worse than we anticipated. And then the wild card is, of course, what global warming could do to the rainforest. We've always known, well, it's going to get hotter, but it's going to get hotter and wetter, which might be okay, or it's going to be hotter and drier. Well, the recent trends, which we aren't sure they'll continue, but the recent trends, especially in Brazil and Indonesia, is hotter and drier. So if that happens, that could be really ugly. And so rainforests, again, are kind of seeing this triple threat of deforestation, more fires, and then hotter and drier climate. And again, if that happens, we could have potential for a massive die-off of most of the world's rainforest if those all really interact the way we might think they do. Again, we don't know that, but there's some speculation on this. This is something we need to watch very, very carefully. So I guess the point here is that unlike previous environmental problems we faced as a society, which are mainly about a certain little place, a lake, a wildlife refuge, or maybe an individual species like a spotted owl or something, we're talking about whole regions losing things like the coral reefs, the Arctic, the whole tropical rainforest. Not to mention all the people who live there, people who live on small island nations that will become flooded, or coastal areas, the Inuit peoples of the north, or people who live on coral reefs themselves, or people who live in the rainforest. What's going to happen to these people? And these problems are really, really a train wreck waiting to happen. And unfortunately, the train's moving pretty damn fast, and we better do something about it right now. Now, a lot of environmentalists will talk and say, oh, we have to take action now, and they try to appeal to your emotions. Well, I want to show you evidence, some science of why we do really have to act now. We can't afford to wait. Well, let's move beyond the rhetoric. Why should we act now versus waiting? Well, one of the reasons we have to act now is because of some science, okay? Again, sorry to throw some science out at you, but a little tiny bit. Two little facts to try to remember. Carbon dioxide. One little fact I forgot about to put on there, but I'll tell you anyway. When you guys will think about mileage, right? If you think about hybrid cars, you're watching your mileage, so you probably know this already. But 1 gallon of gasoline, fill up a milk jug full of gasoline, pick it up, heft it in your hands, hold it. That little thing weighs about 6.5, 7 pounds, right? In your hands, you can hold it. It's mainly made out of carbon atoms, a little bit of hydrogen, a little bit of other junk in there, but mainly it's a jug of carbon. When you burn that carbon in the engine of a car, and it creates carbon dioxide, mixing it with the air, that 7 pounds of gasoline turns into 20 pounds of carbon dioxide gas in the atmosphere, because you took a lot of oxygen from the air and added it to the gasoline. So 1 gallon of gasoline produces 20 pounds of pollution in the air. It's clear, invisible, you don't smell it, you can't see it, it's just up there. Unlike horses, the pollution doesn't show up very quickly. Okay? Wouldn't it be great if our cars left behind carbon turds on the highway like horses did? That'd be great. Wouldn't it be great to see like a Hummer drive by and boom, boom, boom. And then you're driving your Prius, especially a plug-in Prius, and it just goes like dee, 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 and maybe a little rabbit turd once in a while pops out of it. I think that'd be great. I mean, then I think we should be required to go pick them up later. That'd be fantastic. Another good reason to buy a hybrid, right? But anyway, there's a lot of, gallon of gas, 20 pounds of pollution, and the problem is that pollution will stay in the atmosphere on average 110 years. Okay, it's a long-lived pollutant. Unlike acid rain and other things, haze and aerosols and stuff, those will rain out of the atmosphere pretty quickly. CO2 has a lifetime in the atmosphere of over a century. After everyone you know and you love are dead, your pollution from driving your car this morning will still be in the atmosphere. Okay, it's extraordinary. It stays there a long time. So that's one reason that we have a problem. There's long-lived pollution creates a lot of inertia. It's going to keep being a problem for a long time to come. The pollution won't go away for a while. The second one is it takes a long time for the planet to respond to this pollution. It takes a long time for the planet to warm up when you add heat to it from greenhouse gases. Imagine you're making spaghetti. Okay, you get a big pot of water on the stove, you turn on the gas, and you add heat to the pot of water, right? Nothing could be simpler. Does the water instantly turn to its new temperature? No, it takes a while, right? It takes 5, 10, 15 minutes, depending how much water's in the pot, right? So that's called thermal inertia, or heat capacity, right? You all know that. Well, the Earth is like a really, really, really big pot of spaghetti, isn't it? You got water, 71% of the world covered in water. The oceans, on average, are like 3 miles deep of water. That's a big pot of water. So if you're adding heat to Earth, it doesn't take 15 minutes for it to warm up. It takes about 30 to 50 years for it to warm up. So let me drill this into you real quick. The temperature changes we're seeing right now in 2007 are just now about catching up to the pollution we had put into the air by 1967. Okay? I'm about 40, so my entire lifetime's worth of emissions on Earth have not even gotten to have any effect on the planet yet. The bottom line is this: if we stopped using all energy tomorrow, the planet would continue to warm up for 30 to 50 years. There's absolutely nothing you and I could do about it. It's built into the physics of the planet. You cannot change that. So that's a big, big problem. We are effectively a gigantic ship trying to turn. And remember the Titanic? Well, if they turned a little bit earlier, they would avoid the problem. You don't wait till your ship is hitting, about to see the iceberg, then think, maybe I'll turn when I get a little closer. You ought to turn right now. We can't stop on a dime. This thing is big, and we need to do it now. I won't bore you with all the details here, but these are futures of our planet, and we get to choose which one we want. Do we want Earth to be 2 degrees warmer? That's already almost inevitable. Do we want to get it 3 degrees warmer, 4 degrees warmer, 5 degrees? Well, right now, if you extrapolate the trend we have at the moment, here's what it would do. Follow the little red ball. It goes up through here and keep going and going and going and going and going and going. And can't go off that chart anymore. That's what we're doing right at the moment. So all of these are relatively optimistic compared to what we've been doing the last 10 to 20 years. And we have about this period of time to change it between 2007 and about maybe the next 10, 20 years. Everything on that curve will be decided, pretty much. So that's the time to be acting. The more you wait, the harder it is to get from here to here. But if we're on this curve and we want to go to there, it's relatively easy. The next 10 to 20 years, this is possible. After that, it might not be. Are we up to this challenge? I think so, but it's going to be really hard. What we have to do here is go way beyond what would be considered politically realistic and do what's scientifically necessary. Okay? If you think that politics are fixed and you can't negotiate them, but you can ignore the laws of physics, well, cultures that have done that in the past aren't with us anymore. So we've got to be thinking about this really hard. But this is also a huge opportunity. As you all know, energy conservation and things like this are all really good for us. These are things that will make us jobs, make us money. We have the technologies to do this at our fingertips right now. And we have the ability to make renewables. We have new biological fuels. I think ethanol is a great idea. I just don't think corn's the best way to make it at the moment, but it's a good start. We need to get a little smarter about that. Wisconsin is becoming a leader in this area. I'm really excited about it, but there's a lot more research and a lot more work to be done here. We also have the ability, though, in places like Wisconsin to have wind farms with biofuels growing right below them. Wouldn't that be fantastic to be an energy exporter instead of an energy importer in the state? Brazil's going to do this. Why can't we? Well, this is really something we can do today. Let me just show you very quickly. I don't want to run out of time here. But this is what our energy use pattern has been historically and what it's projected to be into the future for the next 40 years or so. It's expected to go up pretty dramatically. We don't want that to happen. What we need instead is, instead of just having more business as usual, just use more and more and more and more, what we need to do is start whittling away at this problem. Here's what we could do by just making buildings more efficient at the end use of electricity. For example, in this room, this is unconscionable to have, a hybrid fest kind of thing in a building. Well, I'm not blaming hybrid fest. This is great. But look at all these light bulbs. These are all like, 120-watt light bulbs that could be replaced for ones that use 10 watts. Why do we still do insane, stupid things like that, throwing away taxpayer dollars on wasted energy that pollutes the atmosphere and makes people sick? Well, we do it every day. So electrical end use efficiency, lighting, air conditioning, refrigeration, with today's technology could reduce energy demands by that much in a heartbeat and save America money and create jobs in this country. But we're not doing it. We can make things more efficient in other end use efficiencies, heating, cooling, making buildings more efficient, a little tighter, a little better insulated, save us money and create jobs. Passenger vehicle efficiencies, not getting everybody to drive a hybrid, but making at least the CAFE standards of this country at least closer by the 30 years from now, maybe closer to, I don't know, something really wild like China. Did you know that the United States, of any country that has fuel efficiency standards, is the lowest in the world? Ours are, what, 20-something miles per gallon? China's are 35, and we wonder why we can't sell American cars anymore? Come on. Now, I'm not even talking about European or Japanese standards. And no technology change. This is an insanely easy thing to do. And you all know how much money you're going to save in the process. Other transportation efficiencies, not just cars, it's trucks, light rail, it's airlines are getting more efficient. Let's make that happen. Let's keep on working on renewables, not doing wild new technologies, just do a little bit more wind, a little bit more solar with today's technology. We're whittling away at it. Another thing we could do later on is something called carbon capture and storage, CCS. That's going to a power plant, like a coal power plant. We're going to still burn coal. There's no way around that. But could we capture the carbon dioxide in the power plant and store it below ground, maybe in liquid form, pump it into old wells or something like that? Why don't we try that? We could whittle away at this. That would be an interesting thing to do. The point here is that we have the ability to do all this stuff. Instead of increasing our energy use like we're planning to, we could cut it in half with 2007 technology, and every single one of those would create jobs in America and save our country lots of money and make us a lot more secure. And we're not doing any of it. This is such a no-brainer, it's not even funny. Unfortunately, though, there's no silver bullet to our energy problems and climate problems. We don't have a single solution. Nuclear power, no way. Wind power, no way. Conservation alone, not really. None of those single solutions is going to make the big difference. But it only took six of them to add up to be a big difference. So instead of a silver bullet, why don't we say silver buckshot? Okay? We just need a few of them. Then we're done. It took six to get us there. I can think of 20 different things that would get you to climate neutrality. You need about 5 to 10 of them. Pick your favorite five, okay? You like nuclear power? Great, put it in there. You like wind power? Great, put it in there. But you need about 5 or 6 of these things before you're done. We need multiple solutions instead of one big one, and that'll be great. So what can we do at home? And I'm sorry, I'm gonna be running out of time a little bit, so I'm gonna go real quick. Well, a lot of you are already doing this, starting at home. I'm not gonna talk about this too much. I wish I had more time. But everybody can go carbon neutral. This is pretty easy to do. My family did this back in 1999 or so, where we cut our emissions by 50% and then try to offset the rest. Now, our car dealer, I won't name who it was, told us that we got the very first Toyota Prius in the state of Wisconsin. How many of you have also been told the same thing? Okay. I know it was on the first truck, and they claimed they were the first dealer to get it. We bought it before there was a test drive model and stuff like that. We got our 7 or 8 year old, first generation Prius. It's been great. Love to get the new one, but I like not having a car payment too. But anyway, so I've met 3 or 4 other people who were told by the same dealer they got their first Prius in Wisconsin. I'm like, oh, those jerks, you know. But anyway, I won't mention the dealer's name, but and they're here today, I think. But yeah. Anyway, the problem here is, though, we didn't meet our goal. We actually exceeded it. We cut our emissions about 60 to 70%, and it was really insanely easy to do. Most of it was the car. A lot of it was heating and cooling, electricity. And, we were really proud of it. Like, wow, we cut our emissions 60 to 70% compared to other people in Wisconsin. Until a friend of mine from Germany said, oh, congratulations, you're now the average German. Or the average, you're a little bit worse than the average Swede. And I'm like, oh, God, you know. So America's got a long, long way to go. It's really easy to cut your emissions in half. Dick Cheney is wrong. And this is really easy to do. The problem is probably cutting it in half again, which is going to be necessary in the long run. That might require some work. This is easy, and you'll make money and save time doing it. It's possible. It's easy. You're not giving up anything. Let me just wrap up by saying one of the other things that we have to do, though, is think really, really long term. The challenges of climate change and sustainability generally require that we think about future generations and really think about the long term perspective. Let me just share one story about that with you, about how people in the past have taken the future on and become very, very cognizant of this kind of issue, working with future generations, and then I'll stop here. The New College at Oxford University. Oxford's a funny place. Their new college was built in 1386, okay? A little different than UW-Madison. Oxford's new college has one of the, it's the two pictures here. They have an amazing dining hall. It's almost like Hogwarts or something, if you're into that. It's this huge dining hall, and up in the ceiling are these tremendous beams in the ceiling made out of whole oak trees that you just can't even put your arms around. They're huge, huge beams in the ceiling, built back in the 1300s. Well, in the last century, people were noticing, like, oh gosh, those beams are rotting a little bit. There's been water and insect damage. They're getting structurally unsound. They needed to be replaced after 700 and something years, or 600 and something years. So they went along and said, well, we can't make beams this big out of wood anymore. How are you going to do it? We'll have to build steel beams and then cover them with a fake kind of oak veneer that would look like an old tree. So people were thinking about that and thinking about it. And somebody said the bright idea, like, why don't we write to the university forester? Oxford has its own forest. They have a professional forestry staff. Why don't we write to them and say, how can we simulate what an oak beam would look like with, you know, oak veneer? Anyway, they write to the university forester, and he writes back and says, what do you mean, you know, oak veneer and steel beams? That's crazy. Your trees are ready now. And they write back, what do you mean our trees are ready now? And the forester writes back again and says, my predecessor, 600 and something years ago, planted trees knowing that 700 years from now you'd need new trees for replacing the beams in the ceiling, and it takes about 600 years for them to grow. Your order is ready now. Okay? It's like, you know, it's like you went to Amazon.com and ordered a book and it's been back ordered for 700 years. It's ready now. So this is great. This is what we need more of, this kind of thinking. Is, and what the beautiful story is of this, and I'll stop here because the next speaker will be coming up, is that they did plant trees once more so that by the year 2700, they'll have the beams ready for you again. Okay? So thanks very much, and we'll stop here, I guess, and see if there's some time for questions. But thanks very much. Thank you.